Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tent 47, A Camping Adventure Gone South, Out West, by Marty O'Hout with Grace Lye. Narrated by Brandon Pollock. Author's Note: Marty O'Hout. Immediately after the events that unfolded in this book, I found myself perched over my keyboard night after night, pecking viciously until the early morning hours. I recorded our camping excursion to the Canadian Rockies as a way to sort through my emotions and to reconcile myself to everything that had happened. The more I typed, the more I remembered of previous ventures into the great outdoors, the conquests, the consequences, the twists of fate. Not all of my audacious expeditions were self-inflicted. I had several willing accomplices over the years. As I flipped through the pages, I felt a great sense of relief. The weight of our disastrous vacation was now off my chest. Grace Lye. Many years ago, I came across the notes my father wrote after our family trip to Canada. Interspersed throughout were stories of adventures he'd had in his youth. Unbelievable experiences I never knew about. These tales were almost too outlandish to be true and needed to be told. I approached my father, and together we worked diligently to bring his stories to life in this book. I fact-checked details and researched locations. We were going to change the names of his friends to spare them embarrassment, but that wasn't necessary. The names he used were authentic nicknames his friends had acquired along the way for things they had done to embarrass themselves. We did change the names of a few other people mentioned in this book, but that is all we changed. Their descriptions are accurate, their kindness probably understated. The names of my family members have not been changed, and their characters are portrayed as they were in 1994 when this story takes place. We had no cell phones then, Google didn't exist, and you had to stop and ask for directions if your paper map couldn't get you there. It was a different time. The majority of the stories from my father's youth took place in 1972, a very different time indeed, a different society, a different world. Now in his 70s, my father continues to live a life full of adventure and travel. He has, admittedly, made a few questionable choices along the way, who of us hasn't, and, quite frankly, is lucky to be alive, as are some of his traveling companions. In The Proud Highway, Hunter S. Thompson writes, "Life should not be a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather to skid and broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, and loudly proclaiming, 'Wow, what a ride!'" This is the story of my father's ride. 1. Grin and Bear It. When you're lying on the ground with your eyeballs about 4 inches above the dirt, a baby possum ambling your way looks like a voracious carnivore. Watching a 500-pound bear approach from this angle will paralyze you. I wanted to warn the others, but I was as rigid as an I-beam, unable to speak. Snapping branches had woken me to the sight of a lone bear illuminated by the full moon over the Sierra Nevada. He passed within inches of my face, his stench so rank it almost pried me from my rigor mortis. I stared at his little stump of a tail as he lumbered away from me and over toward my four sleeping friends. He headed straight for Woody, sprawled out on top of the picnic table, and effortlessly flipped the table sideways. Woody went soaring. He landed with a thud and let out a yell that ended abruptly when he caught sight of the perpetrator. The bear slobbered and grunted about for a bit and then went for our heavy-duty, 50-pound cast-iron cooler. With one flick of his paw, that cooler was 30 feet down the dark road. One more swipe, and the cooler was in the nearby creek. In no time, the bear had ripped it open and was chowing down on about $350 worth of freshly purchased groceries. By now, everyone was wide awake, and we scrambled into our van and pursued the beast down to the creek. When we got his rump square in our headlights, we began honking and screaming and gesturing like lunatics, trying to scare him off. He looked back at us, then wheeled around and reared up, facing off the van, all 8 feet of him, his immense paws and claws spread wide. Our jaws hit the floorboard. He let out a deep roar that darkened our shorts. This bear could have peeled off the top of the van and snacked on us like sardines. We timidly extinguished our headlights, quietly reversed the van, and backed meekly into our campsite. Still watching the bear, we turned off the ignition, and no one moved. That's where all five of us stayed the rest of the night, trying in vain to sleep while listening to the sounds of our dinner guest enjoying his buffet. At dawn, we ventured down to the creek to survey the damage, expecting to see the cooler in pieces. But it was remarkably still intact, just slightly dented on one side. Likewise, the lid, flung about 15 feet downstream, was still usable, though it brandished a couple of deep scratch marks across the top. Perhaps Yogi had some experience in opening heavy-duty coolers. Bits of plastic and containers were scattered about, but every shred of food was gone. As we broke camp later that morning, we were annoyed by all the leaves and twigs sticking to our boots and pants, and then we uncovered the reason for our nighttime visitor. Mel admitted to pouring honey all over the ground and beneath the picnic table in a juvenile attempt to attract a bear to our site. The four of us gaped at him, not sure how to exact recompense for such a boneheaded move, but we all concurred, something had to be done. We considered tying Mel to a tree for a night and pouring honey all over him. Seemed a little extreme, was voted down 3-2. We were largely in favor of having him replenish the groceries our bear friend just polished off, but considering our dire financial straits, including Mel's, this approach probably wouldn't have yielded much. Instead, adopted by a 4-1 vote, we ragged on Mel continuously over the next several hours, along with the next few days, bandying his name about rather disrespectfully. As this process continued, his name morphed from Mel to Melonhead. This seemed judiciously brutal. In fairness to Mel, all of us had grown despondent over our lack of animal sightings. We had been on the road for 4 weeks and hadn't come across a single creature worth writing home about. From the moment we graduated from the University of Cincinnati and hatched our plan to go west for the summer, we had talked about the bears and other wildlife we would see along the way. But the only things we had spotted so far were some deer droppings and what appeared to be raccoon tracks. Frankly, I was relieved about not seeing bears, though I would never have told the guys. Yes, I wanted to see wolves, moose, coyotes, and elk, but not bears. After a nose-to-nose run-in with a couple of cubs 4 years earlier, I would have been happy if the entire species had gone extinct. Even so, the honey debacle opened the floodgates. Woodland animals started appearing everywhere, including more bears, much to my horror and everyone else's delight. And they visited us without any encouragement from Mel. Our moonlight skirmish with the bear was just one of many unforgettable memories we collected that summer. I loved waking up in the woods, cooking over a campfire, going where the road took us, and falling asleep under the wide-open skies. A simple life, immersed in the intoxicating pleasures of the outdoors. Hiking along a fresh mountain stream, watching the sky transform into a kaleidoscope of colors as the sun set, and listening to the wind rustle the tops of the pines. I felt a kinship with nature I'd never known before. At the end of August, as my buddies and I rolled back into Ohio, 13 states and 13,000 miles under our belt, a radical new plan was taking shape in my mind. Forget working in an office. I would move to California and become a park ranger. It was impossible for me to wrap my head around doing anything else. Without a doubt, our trip to the Wild West in 1972 had been the best time of my life. Sure, I had a few bruises, and I had run out of money, and I was still deathly afraid of bears. But for a guy from the Midwest, there was nothing like it, and I couldn't wait to go back. Now here I was, 2 decades later, getting ready to take my 5 children to the Canadian Rockies for a 2-week camping trip. Well, 5 children, 15 bags, 3 boxes of hand-chopped firewood, 2 coolers, 1 monstrous tent, and 1 enthusiastic, if somewhat cautious, wife. And cautious for good reason. I'm not always the most practical guy to live with, especially for a former nursing instructor like Jolene. She has seen firsthand a lot of the mishaps I've narrowly avoided. As I have freewheeled through life, she has proceeded with thoughtful vigilance. I had just arrived home, and during another long day at the office. My job at IBM kept me busy close to 60 hours a week, overseeing a large group of project managers, all dealing with hyperactive schedules and hard deadlines. And before a vacation, I had to put in even more time devising plans to keep everything under control while I was gone, including, sadly, a schedule for calling Seth, my point man. The Europeans do this right. When they go on vacation, they vacate. We simply relocate. I had long since abandoned my ambitions of becoming a park ranger. Meager salaries and small, antiquated housing made me rethink my plan. It would have been difficult to raise a family that way. Instead, I landed a decent-paying job at IBM in North Carolina that allowed us to travel to the big, beautiful parks throughout North America. After our youngest was born 6 years before, Jolene and I had to accept that we wouldn't be whisking off for lavish vacations to the French Riviera on one income. So we came up with an alternative, camping. It was the best means to an end, that end being the ability to explore exciting places for which we barely had the means. The kids loved sleeping in a tent, Jolene loved being outdoors, and I loved not going broke. The house was quiet, everyone asleep. I poured a shot of scotch over a single ice cube and went into the living room. The floor was awash with the expansive spread of our luggage and camping gear. After all the trips we had taken over the years, Jolene had mastered the art of organization and efficiency. I never had to worry about broken equipment, a forgotten tool, or a misplaced item. I picked up the receipt from Jesse Brown's Outdoors lying on the table. Two new sleeping bags. In red pen, she had drawn a smiley face next to, "You saved $20. It always amazed me how committed Jolene was to getting the best possible deal. She had been packing and stacking for a week with the help of our oldest daughter, Julie, who was 15 and the most responsible one of our kids. She was also the most reluctant camper of the brood, but was always willing to give Jolene a hand with any undertaking. After nearly 2 years of planning, I couldn't believe we'd finally be leaving soon. 16 long, relaxing days camping in the beautiful Canadian mountains and forests. But getting there would be anything but relaxing. I regretted again not calling a year in advance instead of only 8 months. Who would have thought, to get a decent nonstop flight from Charlotte to Seattle? Even with all our frequent flyer miles, we couldn't do better than a 6 a.m. departure. Brutal. I looked at my watch. We'd have to get up in less than 5 hours. I dreaded to think what a 4 a.m. wake-up call would do to my kids, along with a 6-hour flight and a 3-hour time change. They'd be jet-lagged zombies by the time we landed. Still, we had seats together on the same flight, so we lucked out there. That was far better than splitting up the family and taking two different planes, the way we had on our trip to California 2 years before. I got down on the floor and checked everything. Shoehorning all our supplies into 21 pieces of luggage had been nothing short of a magic show. Back then, U.S. Air allowed 3 checked bags per passenger, a nicety soon to be abandoned by all airlines. Thank God for large, ever-expandable duffel bags, limited only by the audacity of the packer and brawn of the bearer. Looming large in the middle of all of our stuff were my storied hiking boots. Weighing in at about 15 pounds each, they were industrial-sized and built to withstand the apocalypse. They were bigger than most ski boots. They were bigger than some ski boats. My trusted companions for 20 years, they had carried me to the top of Long's Peak, Mount Whitney, and the Middle Teton. I know, who travels all the way to Wyoming and then only scales the Middle Teton, after my friends and I watched helicopters airlifting stranded hikers off the icy slopes of Grand Teton, we altered our course. The boots were completely waterproof, fireproof, bulletproof, and most importantly, bear-proof, whatever that means. Although in retrospect, they weren't completely waterproof, nor were they all that comfortable. Especially on a cross-country flight crammed into a tiny coach seat. At my size, 6'4", there's nothing comfortable about any plane ride unless you're sitting in first class sipping a cocktail. But wearing the boots was more practical than packing them. On the coffee table, Jolene had neatly assembled all the personalized AAA maps, laying out every mile of our proposed journey. Invaluable. That is to say, they're pure gold when you're on course and amazingly worthless when you aren't. If I'm tempted to veer off onto the back roads we come across, Jolene will rein me in. Can't we just stay on course, Martin? Whenever she addresses me as Martin, anything else in that sentence is not to be taken as optional. I moved on to the 3 heavy boxes of firewood and made sure they were extra secure. But I didn't have to worry. Jolene always used massive amounts of duct tape and added a makeshift handle to the top. The night before, when we tallied up everything, it turned out we could get 2 more checked items onto the plane. Since we still had plenty of logs lying around our yard thanks to Hurricane Hugo, I went out into the drizzle and fog and split up 5 more, even though we already had 1 large box bursting around the edges.
"Marty, what are you doing?" Jolene said as I walked back into the house. "We don't need any more firewood, or any of the ants and termites and beetles that go with it."
I shrugged. She was probably right, but the kids loved piling logs under the campfire at night, and I couldn't bear their disappointment when we ran out of combustible fuel right at the height of her roaring inferno. Plus, she had called me Marty, so I probably had some leeway. After downing the last of the scotch, I climbed the stairs to get a few hours of sleep. Given how absent I'd been from my family of late, with the ungodly hours and pressures, I was eager to start my hard-earned sabbatical. Getting back to nature, to the great outdoors, was exactly what I needed. Camping had always brought us closer together, whether on our trips to the local mountains or to the distant Pacific coast. I was looking forward to that. All in all, it was shaping up to be our ultimate camping vacation, our biggest and potentially last blowout expedition as a whole family. I wanted it to be extra memorable. The little guys, Max and Angela, wouldn't be little much longer, and the older girls, Julie, Grace, and Molly, born within 3 years of one another, were already talking more about boys than about bears. Mom and Dad were more to be tolerated than appreciated. Had I known just how memorable our trip was about to be, we never would have left the house. 2. Into the Woods. On Thursday, July 28, 1994, we arrived at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, and miraculously, so did all 21 pieces of luggage, in pretty much the same condition as when we left Charlotte. I can't say the same about us. None of us had slept except Angela, our youngest, who was now bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Jolene, Julie, Molly, and I drooped and shuffled, while Grace and Max were wired with fatigue. Thank God for Angela. She was our beautiful, benign blessing and the only one with snow-white locks, giving her an angelic appearance to match her personality. Next mission, take possession of the van at Rent-A-Wreck. I turned to Jolene. "This should only take a few minutes." I feigned a stoic smile and took off to find the shuttle, feeling a little criminal for leaving her alone with our mountain of luggage, 4 girls, and 1 wild boy. Max was a happy 8-year-old with explosive energy and excitement, and when fueled by a lack of sleep and inestimable anticipation, raging insanity was just around the corner. The fellow behind the rental counter looked like he'd been in a fight and lost, maybe several fights. His left eye, at least I presumed there had been an eye there at one time, was swollen shut and ringed with purple and black bruises. He advised me matter-of-factly that our 15-passenger van was ready to go, except for 1 minor detail, a rate adjustment of $1,000, upward. Why were adjustments always upward? Was the state of his eye the result of another customer's recent upward adjustment? Hold on. I unfolded the paperwork and showed it to him. I have the details right here in writing. That's nice. The guy didn't even pretend to read the contract. But we're gonna just have to wait for Hank to straighten this out. Who's Hank? The office manager. Sorry, but I can't wait for Hank. I've left a horde of untamed children rampaging through the airport. I gotta get back, pronto. By the blank look on his face, he was clearly unmoved. But since he had already inattentively tossed me the keys, I turned to go. Tell Hank I'll call him. Just as I reached the door, it swung open wildly, and in stepped a huge hulk of a man with Hank
embroidered above his chest pocket. Oh, Christ, there went the $1,000. But thankfully, Hank was a cerebral man. Seeing the terms printed out clearly in the contract, he said,
"We're good to go. You know you're getting a great deal on this van. For another great deal, head up to Larry's grocery store and tell him Hank sent you. And make sure to use Rent-A-Rec again in the future."
"I will." And indeed we did. Our van was easily distinguished in the Rent-A-Rec lot. It was, in fact, the only van in the lot, an ugly gray behemoth that sagged to the left. I had to laugh. If the driver's door didn't come off in my hands, I was taking off with it, no questions. The door remained on its hinges, and I rushed back to the airport, half expecting by now to see security guards chasing my kids up and down the tarmac. Instead, as I pulled up to the curb, I was greeted by the usual antics. Angela was climbing atop her pile of bags, spreading the lower ones across the sidewalk. Max had latched onto a suitcase like a monkey while Grace pulled it, running as fast as her skinny little legs could carry her, both laughing hysterically. Julie and Molly were lying spread-eagle on the luggage, acting like they'd just crossed the Atlantic in steerage. Jolene was standing watch close by, not looking nearly as frazzled as the scene warranted. While I corralled the kids and ushered them into the van, Jolene stuffed all our gear into the inadequate storage space, filling every nook and cranny, somehow manufacturing space where none had been. We had planned to load up with as much food and supplies as possible to avoid paying wilderness outpost prices after crossing the Canadian border. With a bit of trepidation, we took Hank's advice and drove up the road to Larry's. There was a picture of Larry plastered right next to the store entrance. He bore an amazing resemblance to Hank. We grabbed 3 shopping carts and dispersed down the aisles. Jolene and Angela were in charge of the hearty sustenance, like hot dogs, sausage, hamburger patties, and lunch meat. The 3 older girls, cereal and chips, and Max and I, everything else. Hanging on to the front of the cart, my overzealous son kept telling me to go faster as I loaded up with paper towels, tissues, and toilet paper, and then picked up a couple of cans of lighter fluid, matches, and the last bottle of lamp oil for our 4 lanterns. We converged with the rest of the gang at the checkout. Jolene and Angela had amassed enough meat to make a carnivore gag and several bags of ice to keep it fresh. The girls' cart was chock-full of Cheez-Its, Goldfish, and Cheetos, along with bags of marshmallows, bars of chocolate, and boxes of graham crackers for s'mores, not to mention several boxes of cookies and sugary cereal. Jolene didn't allow junk food at home, but was lenient on vacations, and the kids took full advantage of that. Larry and a couple of his brothers spent several minutes stuffing the $1,000 worth of procurements on top of and in between the kids, who were nestled across the back seats, simultaneously giggling and groaning about this arrangement. I covertly stashed all the flammables inside the back door to reduce the likelihood of untimely combustion. Finally, we were ready to get the show on the road. I steered the van north out of town and up into the mountain wilderness, each of the kids clutching their favorite bag of munchies. As we gained altitude, the scenery grew more beautiful and panoramic. The tension was just leaving my body when a sudden loud pop came from the back seat.
"What the hell was that?"
My eyes shot up to the rearview mirror.
"My Cheetos exploded!"
Max screeched in delight. I looked over my shoulder and saw Cheetos everywhere and ravenous kids going after them.
"You're telling me that the bag just randomly popped open, that you had nothing to do with it?"
"Dad," Julie said, "all the bags are getting bigger."
"What?"
Just then, I opened my mouth wide to pop my ears, and it dawned on me what had happened. More eruptions were only a few additional feet of elevation away.
"Let them explode,"
Max said, shoving several Cheetos into his mouth.
"Then we won't have to open them ourselves."
He smiled a giant smile, exposing his 2 large front teeth, now coated in a dusting of orange. As the other kids shouted their agreement, Jolene turned in the passenger seat, doing her best to stifle the grin.
"Absolutely not," she said.
"I can fix this,"
Molly said with more confidence than any 12-year-old has the right to possess. She tossed her long, thick hair over her shoulders, removed her earring, and used it to poke tiny holes in all the remaining chip bags, delaying their consumption by at least a couple of days.
"Gee, thanks a lot, Molly,"
the other kids groaned in unison. As the sun was setting, we drove across the Canadian border, 3 hours from Kamloops, our final destination for the evening. Getting there had taken almost twice as long as I had originally calculated, which I should have anticipated due to my mediocre scheduling and estimating skills. I had been driving for a while and needed a break, so I pulled over and we all got out of the van to admire the view. I couldn't help but notice how vast and serene the surroundings had become, just as we had hoped. All was good, except for my feet. They were killing me. Encased in boots for 24 hours, they needed a respite. After much grunting and straining, I managed to pry my feet out of the mammoth clodhoppers, and I placed them down on the door well, closed the door, and drove bootless into the evening. My stomach was growling as we pulled into Kamloops. Instead of looking for healthy dinner options, I pulled right into the whippy dip, knowing this would be a big treat for the kids, for me too, and it would probably take us right to the brink of what Jolene referred to as our garbage food intake. The kids all talked at once about what they were going to get, each trying to outdo the other in extravagance. I was also salivating over the possibilities. As soon as I parked, Jolene and the kids piled out of the van and rushed over to the window. Before joining them, I reached down into the door well to retrieve my trusty hiking boots. What the? Where was my left boot? Panic struck my haggard brain. I rummaged through all our stuff, but I knew it wasn't there. It was like searching for a boulder in a sandbox. If the boot had been there, I'd have seen it. I must have accidentally knocked it out of the van right before I shut the door. That meant it was some 150 miles back, lying lonely and likely flattened on the side of the road. I leaned against the van and debated going back and scouring the highway, but it was almost 10, and my boot was over 2 hours away. My kids stared at me blankly, licking their cones. Jolene patted me on the shoulder. "Come on, Martin, get over it. We aren't going back. Besides, those boots were disgusting." So, that was it. A retrieval mission wasn't going to happen. To make matters worse, all I had left to wear for the next 2 weeks was one pair of flimsy tennis shoes and one right boot if such a strange need arose. Bereavement set in. I couldn't function properly for several minutes. I loved those boots, the first and only ones I had ever purchased, even though they never fit quite right. The store didn't have my size when I bought them. For 20 years, I had worn size 13 boots on my size 14 feet. I went through a lot of moleskin because of those faithful boots. To ease the pain, I ordered a triple cone with extra chocolate and a cherry on top and wandered over to the payphone. I needed to distract myself by focusing on the next task of the evening, securing accommodations for the night. I began calling around to the local lodging establishments, only to discover, most incredibly, that every single hotel room in Kamloops was occupied. How could Kamloops be full? Who had even heard of Kamloops? Feeling a pang of desperation, I called a hotel up the road in Barrier, praying there would be a vacant room in a town whose dot on the map was smaller than the width of the line for the highway.
"Barrier Dive In, Liam speaking."
His voice was so lifeless I was sure I had woken him from a deep sleep. "Do you have any vacancies?"
"There's one room left, but I can't hold it for you. And just so you know, it doesn't have air conditioning."
"Please hold the room," I said. "We're heading there right now." Who cared about air conditioning? We were in British Columbia. Given that there was only one room left, I'd be forced to play the invisible children trick. Upon check-in, I would bring one or two children into the lobby while concealing the existence of my other three to avoid having to pay a penalty for having seven people in one room. Cramming seven people into one room is penalty enough. Hard to believe, but the room was still available an hour later when we arrived. It was also hard to believe that any room this far north on the planet could be so hot. I discovered why when I tried to open the windows to get some fresh air. They were nailed shut. I hastened back to the front office to ask about prying them open.
"There's nothing I can do about it,"
Liam said, shifting the toothpick in his mouth. I appealed first to a sense of pity, then to a sense of perspiration by making a big show of wiping my brow.
"Sorry."
He didn't sound all that sorry. Resigned, I let out a deep breath and glanced around. That's when I noticed the stack of old, reused Pepsi bottles in the corner, all of them partially filled with a brown liquid.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?